October of 1995, there was this huge anti-peace rally on the streets of Jerusalem. About 50,000 people showed up. Some were holding signs of Yitzhak Rabin dressed in a keffiyeh to make him look like Yasser Arafat. Others chanted hateful slogans, angry slogans. Death to Rabin! Rabin's a murderer! Rabin's a traitor! One person actually circulated a flyer with Rabin dressed in an SS uniform. And then 1 month later, November 4th, a fellow Jew murdered Rabin. This year, I am deeply disturbed by what I hear in the public sphere regarding the language of anger. We know that words are not sticks and stones that just break bones, but words and rage can be lethal. It's not just something to brush off. We're playing with fire. People are name-calling at political rallies. Shoot her for treason. Lock her up. Some are trying to outlaw burkinis because, they should just be like everyone else. Some want to build a wall. Others want to charge us for the wall. We hear about dangerous Muslims and immigrants who are going to take our jobs. First, some angry people kill black kids, and then others kill white cops. This rhetoric is dangerous. Proverbs said it best, one who speaks rashly is like the piercing of a sword. Anger is in the air. So are we born angry? I'm not sure. When one of my children, I won't name names, when she was born, she cried all the time. And I interpreted that as anger. So I responded with giving her what I thought she needed. And the anger actually worked for her. Yet as we mature, we learn to communicate in different ways and have our needs heard. That said, our current world seems to have a very short fuse nowadays. We get riled up by injustice, inequality, political violence, police violence, climate change, billionaires buying elections, and dysfunction in Congress. Some recent surveys suggest that white middle America is angry because how they survived economically in the past no longer works. For example, the farmer or the small realtor or the direct service supplier doesn't have the same buyers as in the past. Their old economic ways no longer work. The single mother without health care and child care is like a ticking bomb ready to explode. These people fear that they're being edged out, and they're scared and angry. Some say our anger rises because of how we experience living in the world. For example, 70% of black people express anger about the way they are treated by society, as opposed to 18% of white men. I heard a story told by the lawyer, filmmaker, and activist Valerie Kerr. She's a third-generation Sikh. And this was 4 days after 9/11 happened. You see, her Punjabi professor was wearing a turban, and he was on a bus. And one guy got up and started screaming at him on the bus. He said, go back to your country. Get off of this bus. And the professor started praying quietly because he didn't want to be another victim of anti-Muslim or Sikh hatred after 9/11. And then something remarkable happened. A few people on the bus got up and calmed the guy down and said, no, you don't know who this is. This is a distinguished professor. Sit down, be quiet. And eventually the bus came to a stop and the professor did what all of us would do, which is get off of that bus quickly. But what's weird is that the abusive man then followed him. And they got off of the bus and the abusive man walked up to him and put out his hand. And the professor shook his hand. And the man said, I'm sorry. My granddaughter was on the second plane that hit the second tower. And I'm tired. And I'm angry. We're also angry because we just don't get each other anymore. We don't see the other. And it's not just in the larger world. It happens in our personal lives. In relationships with those we love and trust most, we get mad when we feel ignored, passed over, unappreciated, misunderstood, disregarded, taken for granted, or we're just tired of feeling hurt over and over again. Sometimes we can't let go. We go to bed angry, and we wake up angry. Now, every marriage therapist will tell you not to go to sleep angry, but clearly they've never been married. It's an epidemic. The anger I see in society, as well as the anger we experience interpersonally, feed off of one another. They cover pain and sadness, and contribute to a poisonous rage that plagues our streets and our homes. And what makes matters worse is that we've created relationships where we don't have to interact with people who aren't like us anymore. It's rare that we even engage in deep conversation with people who are different. Bill Bishop, in his book, Big Sort, argues that for the past 3 decades, we've been voluntarily sorting ourselves into homogeneous communities, like-minded tribes, not only in our neighborhoods, but also in places of worship, in volunteer groups, where people look alike and think alike. And then our beliefs are reflected and amplified with the people we choose to be around, and our thinking becomes even more extreme. Take the dichotomy of inner city Detroit and its affluent suburbs as one example. This summer, I traveled to Detroit to officiate at a wedding, and beforehand, I contacted my Catholic freshman year roommate. I hadn't seen her in 20 years. Although I've always had a soul-to-soul connection with her, because I hadn't seen her in a long time, I was a little nervous. She has 3 children. I have 3 children. She has a higher degree in education, so do I. But I was worried. I was worried because she lives in a small town environment, and maybe she was going to be close-minded, ultra-white, right-wing, homophobic. Would she believe that divorce and transgender people are unacceptable? Well, it turned out that she wasn't any of these things. She is conservative in her principles. But we both admitted that the opportunity to connect deeply with someone who is so much not like us is a gift. We were able to hear each other, our beliefs about God, marriage, divorce, gay rights, transgender people, family strife. We questioned each other. We disagreed almost on every count. But we listened to each other with genuine interest. And she sadly admitted to me that even at the college where she teaches at, she doesn't feel free to express her conservative thinking, lest she be criticized. An encounter like this helps us diffuse political and interpersonal misunderstandings and lessen the potential for danger, but it's sadly the exception. And it's not just happening in America. The 27-year-old Muslim French woman, Mira Hassin, when interviewed by the New York Times, said the following: "Even if we were to make every effort to try and be integrated, we're constantly reminded that to be properly and completely integrated, we must give up our principles and our religion. And so what do?" She says, "We isolate ourselves. And once you start isolating yourself, you're no longer integrating." All this separating and sorting is dangerous and points to how complicated and layered anger is. Rabbi Abraham Twersky says that anger really has three parts to it. The first is simply a feeling of anger, and there's nothing wrong or right with feelings, it's just a feeling, and it can give us information and elucidate parts of ourselves. The second is rage. Rage is how we react to that feeling. Do I walk away? Do I punch the person? Do I call him or her nasty names? And the third is resentment. How long am I going to hold on to that anger? 1 hour? 22 days? 22 years? Twersky says there isn't much we can do about our feelings of anger, except put them in perspective. But we can control how we react and how long we hold on to our anger. Before I explain why anger can be so caustic, I recognize that sometimes anger can actually be very useful and can even lead to change. First of all, some of us in this room were probably brought up to be good little boys and girls. And being a nice boy or a nice girl meant not expressing feelings of sadness and hurt and disappointment. And so we suppressed our feelings of anger. And if you fall into this category, I applaud you for getting in touch with your hurt and unshackling yourselves from your upbringing and giving yourself a voice in this world. And I also warn you not to get sucked up into the exhilaration of your new skill. It's also important to recognize that most intimate relationships die or become alienated if there's unexpressed anger and sadness. That said, a person doesn't have to lash out when expressing one's natural feelings of anger. And there are many ways to voice our hurt. The art is being able to uncover one's pain while not insulting or blaming the person. And it's also confusing, I'm sure you're thinking right now, that there's anger in politics and in the Bible, and all of that can sometimes lead to very positive change. For example, Rosa Parks, the civil rights movement, the moral indignation of our biblical prophets, they all express their outrage at the injustices of their time. However, Righteous indignation toward a community because of immoral actions look different than the anger of one person striking out with fury against another. One is about uncovering societal unfairness and trying to change the world for good, and the other is the consequence of burying personal pain as a result of hidden sadness. It's also true that God's character in the Hebrew Bible is sometimes angry. Psalms shockingly says, God gets angry how often? Every day, Psalm says. And yet, God's anger seems to be justified for good reasons, like idolatry or rebellion or oppression of the poor. But the key is, it's not about God's ego. It's based in God's desire for ultimate love and compassion toward humanity. The Psalms teaches, yes, God does get angry, but for a moment. Because one who succumbs to anger succumbs to bad judgment. And yet, even though there are positive things about anger, and we need to honor them, our rabbis teach us that acting from a place of anger is dangerous. Maimonides, who always takes the middle road, if you know him, the 11th century commentator, he says that there's no middle road when it comes to anger, that anger is a midah ra'ah, an evil quality. He says the life of an irate person is not a true life. By quoting the Talmud, he says that anyone who becomes angry is like someone who worships idols. Now that seemed crazy at first. How can you compare an angry person to someone who worships idols? Here's how. Because when we get so riled up in our anger, even evidence to the contrary, or examples that paint a bigger picture of the person who we love, is ignored. This is idolatry, because we stop seeing the divine spark in each other. All we see is fire. We become clouded by that anger, and we forget. And now this might be very uncomfortable for those of you who struggle with the notion of God, but I'm going to say it anyway. We forget that perhaps God placed that person in our life. Rabbi Schnorr Zalman of Liadi explains that when we're angry at someone else, it's really a wake-up call. It's like the shofar blasting in our ears, saying to us, what's going on? What is your anger about? Rather than victimizing the person who's doing that act to you, the question is, what is this anger telling me about myself at this moment? Anger is equated to idolatry when we blame the other because we get caught up in our own hurt and our own frustration, rather than focusing on what God wants us to look at in ourselves. And if this God thing just totally doesn't work for you, then translate it this way. Notice when you get angry and ask yourself, what is my anger saying about me? What wound in my life is my anger covering up? Now, I used to think that it's healthy and important for us to express our anger, not to conceal and keep things bottled up, because it can lead to depression, anxiety, and withdrawal. But now I see that the opposite extreme is also corrosive. I see how easy it is to fall into a destructive pattern of criticism and complaining with those we love. How anger can be like an addictive drug. It gives us this surge of energy and false purpose, and then becomes self-absorbing and keeps us from seeing or hearing the other. Once we enjoy that high, we want it back again and again. Because as the Talmud teaches, rage produces nothing but rage. But ultimately for me, the most compelling reason to let go of anger is because it's not the person I imagine God wants me to be. I know some of you may be rolling your eyes again at the God thing, but regardless of what each of us believe, there is someone better who we're destined to become. And today is the day that we figure out how to become that person once again. I want to be able to look at myself in the mirror and say, I'm behaving as the person I aspire to be. So not speaking to a brother, or not speaking to a son, or not speaking to an old friend is not who we want to be. Holding on to resentment and self-righteousness is not who we want to be. Not being intimate with those we love or those who are most dear to us is not who we want to be. This is the reason that speaks to my Kishkas the most. And by the way, I'm sure we're all thinking about someone else who you wish was here listening to this sermon. It's not about them. It's about us. The real question we ask ourselves on Rosh Hashanah is, what kind of person do I want to be? Am I behaving like that person? Am I holding on to unnecessary anger? Am I seeking the high that anger provides? Am I letting my anger turn into rage long after the expiration date? And if you answered yes to any of these questions, and your anger is preventing you from being the best you can be, let me offer three ways to address this struggle. First, slow down and hit pause. The book of Ecclesiastes urges, don't be quick to anger, for anger lodges in the bosom of fools. And the rabbis of the Mishnah counseled, be slow to anger and easy to pacify. These Jewish teachings are not living in the clouds. They're not saying, oh, don't get angry. Instead, they're about diminishing the intensity of our reactions, calming our natural responses to be sharp and ungracious, developing a longer fuse, opening our hearts, and learning to let go of the anger that we will have so we can recover more quickly when we do get upset. The second is distance. Distance followed by empathy. Sometimes distance is simply just time. Sometimes it requires a full mind-body physical exercise, like taking three breaths. Sometimes distance is an emotional state that we create in our hearts when we stop, so we can stop feeling enmeshed with our anger. This detachment, by the way, doesn't mean that we have to be cold and uncaring. The opposite is sometimes the most powerful change we can make in our lives. When we are able to stand back and realize that the other person isn't doing something to us, but rather whatever that person is doing that's igniting something in our souls, it's a reflection of their challenges and our challenges. And when we have this empathy toward the other, then it's much easier to control our anger. Rabbi Twersky, who I mentioned before, he tells this great story about his dad. He said that every time someone would do something hurtful to his dad would say, "What so-and-so did was foolish. I feel sorry for him. If he only knew what he did, he wouldn't have done it." So essentially, compassion and anger can't live together. Pausing, followed by distance and empathy, are important first steps toward distancing ourselves from destructive rage. And there's a third technique I'm offering: keeping a daily record on your iPhone. An anger list. So at the end of a day or a week, you can look at this list and reflect on who did I get angry at and why did I get angry. So I have this app on my phone. It's called Evernote. Kids, don't ever read my app. And I have my work list on it. I have my personal to-do list on it. And I have my anger list on it. And once a week, I sort of review it. Who pushed my buttons? What needs were frustrated? Was it our need to be right, to be heard, to be appreciated, to be taken seriously, to be valued, to be in control, to be seen? Pushing pause, creating some distance with empathy, can open our hearts. Our anger list can help us focus on how we need to move forward and what pushes our buttons. So I want to end with a story. In the Russian yeshiva at Novordok in the late 1800s, there was this dormitory. And back then, the kids just had to, the young adults, had to figure out where they lived. And most students lived in local homes that had extra rooms. And most landlords were thrilled to have a yeshiva student in their home. But there was one exception. One building with more than 20 rooms was owned by a bitter woman who was a widow. And she ridiculed and criticized every student who lived in her building. Her anger turned her to turn off the water on Fridays right before Shabbat or turn off the electricity just to be mean. And her harassment became so intolerable that after a while, every single yeshiva student just moved out of her building. Except for one. Except for Yosef Geffen. And so one morning, he's walking back from synagogue, and she starts yelling at him, "You're crazy! How can you stay in this building? All the other boys have moved out. Why do you insist on staying?" And Yosef paused for a moment and said softly, "I stay here because of you. I realize that you live alone, and I worry that one night you'll fall or become ill, and you'll call out for help, and no one will be there. I understand that when you yell at us, you're letting out your frustration and anger at being a struggling widow. And that's why I felt like it was right for me just to stay here in case you needed any help. this is not the answer that she thought she'd hear. She was so surprised by Yosef's concern that she pleaded with the student, "Forgive me. It never dawned on me that I was the reason why you were staying. How kind and gracious of you." And for days, she only spoke caring words to the students she met. Slowly, word got around that she wasn't as angry as she used to be. And the students started moving back into the building until all the rooms were filled. This year, let's be like Yosef and like the widow. The student who was able to see the sadness underneath the anger, and the widow who was able to be vulnerable enough to admit it. Today is Rosh Hashanah, our moment to reach beyond the anger we hear on the TV, on our iPhone, on the streets, and in our homes. Let's free ourselves from the rage that really masks our sadness and compose a symphony of compassion for the world, for our community, and for ourselves. Amen.